Hello, this week's Bruin podcast is with me, Guy Foster, speaking to Claire Hart, the manager of the JPM US Equity Income Fund, and it's not intended as investment advice. But hopefully you will enjoy Claire's observations on markets, on politics and interest rates. But bear in mind that we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruin Dolphin, and we may hold any of the securities mentioned. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And as Claire says,
one of the things that I don't want to say I'm shocked, but I'm shocked.
So you're about to find out what Claire found so shocking, but to avoid being shocked yourself, remember that investing your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. With that said, on with the podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Bruin podcast with me, Guy Foster, the head of research here at Bruin Dolphin, and delighted to be joined for this podcast by Claire Hart, who is the manager of the very successful JP Morgan US Equity Income Fund. Claire, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
So I think given the area that you invest in for equity income in a market that isn't always renowned for having lots of income, well, it's more renowned for its growth, I suppose, than its income in contrast to the UK. Do you find that companies do a good job of making that distinction between when it's a good time to buy back shares and when it's a good time to pay dividends?
So I would say, so thanks for your time. And I think it's a really interesting question. I would say they don't.
Right.
And so that's why, you know, I call out one of the asset managers that kind of, I don't say he gave it as an excuse, but to me it was an excuse. And so I think companies can be good about buying back stock. I think, again, the banks have said that they're holding off on it. I think it's to placate the regulators. But I think companies deciding that they're not going to pay the dividend, instead buy back stock, I don't buy that as an explanation or an excuse. I think companies that have buyback, I'm not opposed to a buyback program in place. I don't want it at the expense of the dividends, certainly. But I think about buybacks, if you have a dollar, I think, you know, a dollar of a dividend is truly a return to shareholders. If your second dollar is available, it could be available for either M&A or a buyback. When a company's buying back its own stock, I want to hear it's not, as I don't believe this idea of it's a way to return money to shareholders. That's not true. I think it's really a way of thinking about, it's in lieu of M&A. It's in lieu of buying another piece. Why should you go out and buy a business or company or part of another company, a business line from someone else? Why go buy that if there are better returns that you can see by buying back your own stock? I'm happy to have that conversation with companies. I don't buy into this idea of it's a bad time for dividends. Our stock's so cheap, we have to redirect that money to buybacks. I don't have that conversation with our companies, and I wouldn't buy into it, basically.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Now, you mentioned the banks, and you've got reasonable weighting, of course, of financials. Last week, we had quite a downbeat message on interest rates from the Fed. I'm not sure how surprised everyone was by it, but certainly it implied that the FOMC members have quite a flat trajectory for interest rate expectations from here. So how does that affect the ability of the sector to perform?
I would say, to your point, yes, for the banks in particular, there's the net interest income, the NIM that people talk about. I would say, you know, we were talking about the shape of the yield curve, that impacts the net interest margin. But to the extent that they're allowed to continue to lend and, you know, sort of continue to make loans to people, the net interest income can still grow, even if the NIM is not expanding. And so if I look at, you know, some of the banks, I think that people are sort of well aware now that we are basically in a, you know, global downtrend. I don't say pandemic, whatever it might be, in terms of non-expansionary. Let's just put it that way. It's not an expansionary environment, globally speaking. And so the banks are, you know, I believe the shares are discounting that. So when I think about a bank, and obviously interest rates, to your point, important, but remember, for these banks, you know, 50% of the, up to 50% of the earnings stream can be related to fees as well. And so, and appropriate fees for mortgages, all that sort of stuff. So it's not 100% just sort of spread lending, so to speak, that's driving these banks. And we also have names like, you know, Morgan Stanley, for example, has, you know, asset management, investment banking revenue. Somebody like a Bank of America, yes, they have a piece of it that is based on the spread and the lending. But in addition to a diversified lending book, they also have things like, you know, banking, capital markets businesses, fixed income trading. So they have other sort of fee income levers in there that I think that they can work with. And, you know, I think, too, most importantly for the banks is feeling good about the credit quality and the financial health, because if what we're talking about in terms of the NIM, the interest margin, and the, all of that, you know, impacts the earnings per share, which is important. But the real way that, in my mind, a bank can come under pressure is if the credit is not good, because that basically is, that's a body blow. That will drill a hole in the balance sheet, and that's when you can really lose the money in a bank. And that's during the financial crisis. That's what the problem was. People start to doubt the book values, and then you had banks trading at fractions of book because people didn't believe book. You weren't even using PE anymore. People didn't even care because it wasn't about the earnings. It was about whether or not the bank was going to be around. So again, not a fat and happy environment, so to speak, in terms of the yield curve. That being said, you or I, somebody who walks into a bank today to get a mortgage, they're not giving it to you for free because rates are so low. It might be a lower rate, but they're still going to pick up 200 or 300 basis point spread over what they're charging people or willing to pay people on their deposits. So the banks can continue to make money in a difficult environment. And I, you know, again, that's why we've kind of picked through the banks that we think are well positioned to kind of appropriate for the portfolio.
And in terms of credit quality, then, I mean, is that it's probably quite a difficult environment to assess that as well, isn't it? With just the extent of the economic uncertainty that's ahead of us, how do you deal with that?
So for credit quality, first and foremost, it's one of the things I fall back on is the idea that we, you know, for a lot of the banks in the portfolio, we've had them for many years, sort of in different weights, of course. And if someone doesn't, you know, no longer makes the cut, like a Wells Fargo, you know, we move it out of the portfolio. But I would say I've seen these banks and seen kind of the way their charge-offs run for the better part for 20 years. And so, again, it's no guarantee of the future, but, you know, when we say we have banks that we think have better credit quality, it's based on the experience and what we've seen them pull out in terms of actual reported numbers in different environments of different credit cycles. So there's a little bit of, like, sort of history for me to work with in terms of personal history, investing history with these banks. And then moving forward to that, in this, again, this really unusual environment, one of the things that I don't want to say I'm shocked, but I'm shocked that the United States, the federal government got right was the CARES Act and the way they put it together. And so I never would have given them credit, but they were able to see that, you know, two things. First of all, the way that they structured the unemployment, the one-time special benefits and the expansion of the unemployment benefits that would be available to people, they did it early on in the crisis when, you know, stores started to shut, restaurants, bars, things shut. There's a lot of people, obviously, in those types of jobs. It's, you know, they call it the gig economy, right? So people who, you know, drove or Uber for a living and didn't have a W-2 the way other people might in the United States if you work at a bank or something like that. So they were able to really see that there was a big part of the economy that was not a regular office worker, and you had to be able to get them and quantify some unemployment benefits to them. And so they really loosened the terms about who could apply for unemployment based on the kind of previous job you had. You know, again, maybe you were a waitress, and so it was hard for you to come up with a W-2. But they really expanded. So they were able to capture a lot of this gig economy workers and make sure that they got paid as well in unemployment benefits. So you captured more of the people that were actually being unemployed. You figured out how to get money to them. So that really is going to help in terms of credit quality for things like credit card payments. Mortgages that you can offer forbearance to, maybe, you know, there's lots of forbearance programs that are available through the banks, but not as many people are hitting them as they thought they might, right? And so there's that in terms of making sure that people got the money, and then the way they did it directly. And so, you know, during the financial crisis, they pumped lots of liquidity to the banks, and the banks kind of sat on a lot of it and didn't make it available. And this was more, in addition to sending money out to individuals, the gig economy, they went to small businesses and said with the PPP program, we can either lend you money or you can get a loan, but you have to keep, call it 75% of your workforce in place. The money you borrow from us has to go towards paying the employees you want to keep on your payroll. So they actually got to the small businesses too, which is a big part of the economy in terms of new companies that are formed and employment, people with less than 50 workers. So they, again, were able to connect with that, and that is going to help in credit quality too, because those small business loans are not insignificant if you think about credit card companies and also within the banking sector. So you're right. It's not going to be perfect. It's hard to really get comfortable around credit broadly, especially during a crisis. But I think those two pieces have helped so far. And the fact that really, if you look at unemployment, it's starting to rebound. I wasn't sure the, you know, kind of the 1 to 3 month kind of time period in terms of assistance they're offering small companies was going to work. But the United States has started to reopen. We've got major cities reopening. The markets obviously is reflecting that. People are starting to spend. Again, the unemployment numbers look dramatically better than people thought. It is looked like it's sort of it's been a bridge across the chasm. And I think it, again, I wasn't sure it would go all the way across the other side. But I think it bought the markets and bought people the time they might need before they actually get back to work. So I think the credit outcome is so far looking a bit better than I had thought. In terms of, you know, if instead it had been sort of down in the kind of the March timeframe in terms of NPS, we can't see reopening for a year, you would have had a worse credit outcome than I think we're going to have.
Okay. And to move on to, I guess, some sectors that have seen, instead of a headwind from this, a bit of a tailwind, yeah. I think it would be like technology and healthcare have been the real sort of big winners, I suppose, in investment terms from the coronavirus. Has this been something that you've been able to participate in, or is it difficult with the dividend focus?
So I would say maybe technology first. So Microsoft is one of the largest holdings we have in technology. And the reason we own Microsoft, kind of even coming into this, was they're a share gainer in the area of cloud computing. Amazon is the share donor, so to speak, in terms of AWS. But Microsoft, as more and more applications and services, it has to be moved to the cloud. More people are working from home. You don't have one or two backup sites. You know, JP Morgan doesn't have, I don't know, two, three, whatever, backup sites in New York City anymore. You've got 6,000 people working from their homes. You have 6,000 backup sites. So you need cloud computing. You need to move things to the cloud because people are not in one spot. And P.S., they're probably not all going to be in one spot again like we were called a year ago. You know, people talk about bringing offices back to maybe 50% capacity. And it's not because people are going to double down on their office space. It's probably because the other 50% are going to be working from home. And I know personally at JP Morgan, my experience working from home has been stunningly good. Technology. I would say less tech issues now that I'm working from my office at the house versus at my desk. And we have very nice technology people at JP Morgan. But I guess my point is for someone like a Microsoft, we've benefited from that. And again, we didn't buy it because we thought there'd be a global pandemic, but it's accelerated the sort of the shift forward in terms of people needing this, these types of services. And then in healthcare, from my perspective, I think about something like Gilead, which we, had in the portfolio, we were able to make money from that. We didn't buy it because we thought they were going to have one of the kind of the leading solutions for the pandemic. We bought it because it was trading, call it a couple of years ago, 10 times forward earnings, and people thought their HIV and hepatitis platforms were going to go away, and they had nothing else in the pipeline. You fast forward to today, we have somebody like a Gilead, we have someone like a Lilly that has, sort of an antibody therapy that's in human trials, someone like a J&J in the portfolio where people had written J&J off, and because half the company is consumables, like Band-Aids and things you can see and use and disposable. Half the company that was pharma, people basically had written off is nothing ever comes out of that pipeline, and that's what it's priced for. But then again, you fast forward to today, and they're working on a vaccine as well, and they're one of the front runners for having a vaccine. So I would say it's not, again, we don't have exposure in terms of pharma in the portfolio because we're thinking global pandemic. But I think people forget that there's art and science in any one of these companies in our portfolio. Now actually have a leg in the race, so to speak, to try and come up with a cure or benefit. And that from our perspective, that's worked really well in our healthcare part of the portfolio. And I think it will continue to do so because, you know, if you listen to some of these CEOs, they'll make the point, you know, it takes a while to come up with a virus. And even once you do, you need millions of doses. And this is going to take time. So this is not an investment idea that has come and gone. This, I think, thematically is going to continue to work in the technology and the healthcare sectors in particular over the foreseeable future.
Okay, I want to ask you, I guess, a bit about the sort of general environment in the US. Obviously, we've had not just the coronavirus, but also these instances of protests, unrest at things that are going on. And together, they are making for quite an unhappy electorate. I wonder what you think that means in terms of the chances of seeing the president reelected.
So I would say, yes, we have a very unhappy electorate, you know, I'm both Republican and Democrat. I think, again, this is my personally, it's not, I don't know, James Morgan's opinion. I think Biden's chance the Democrats, for them to pull this together, I think in the past the problem has been that they have had so many options that they don't settle on a candidate really concretely, and then they split the ballot and then they lose. I think Biden, in order to make his ticket really strong, he's already said he's going to have a woman. I think Condoleezza Rice, who was our Secretary of State, I think if he were to, you know, she would have to come back to being a Democrat. She was a Democrat before. I think if he put her on the ticket, that would be really powerful. And then we'd have a ticket that people could buy into. If he puts if he puts the vice presidential candidate up there that people don't like, then I think it's basically a shoo-in for Trump, because he's the incumbent. And so Hillary Clinton, which I don't think is on his list, obviously, but if he were to put her on the ticket, she lost the last election. I think then you're right. I mean, Trump would probably just get to stay. That's probably it. But I think, you know, for us as investors, whoever gets picked as the president doesn't really change kind of what we're doing and how we're going to do it. Quality company, reasonable valuation, pays a dividend. It changes the kind of the names that can fall into that pool. I would say regardless of who might come out as the winner, healthcare, to your point before, healthcare is going to be a really interesting place to continue to make money, because everybody has a policy on healthcare, and the healthcare names, like the pharma, but also managed care names, that they're going to be an interesting place. I think there's going to be a lot of activity. I foresee a lot of moving around within that space for us in the coming year as we come into the election, because that's an area that gets talked about, you know, quite a bit.
And so do you think drug pricing would come back under the microscope again then? I mean, it's been something that candidates from both sides have expressed their dissatisfaction with from time to time, but notably, I don't think President Trump really ever got around to doing much about it.
And I have to say that if he were reelected, I don't think he will. I think part of it is that he was one of the first with photo ops out there with people talking about, you know, they've put together this dream team of companies in the United States partnering with the federal government to come up with a solution to this. And to their credit, the pharma companies, I think, have really gotten this, you know, I hope is them being human. Part of them is being savvy. Any of them that have come out that look like front runners, so to speak, in terms of a vaccine or cure or treatment, have said, P.S., we're not going to try and make money off this. So this is not, they are not dumb. They're not going to wind up in a situation where, if you think about like Mylan, for example, with the EpiPen, they came under a tremendous amount of pressure because they had a life-saving device and drug that people could not afford. And they wound up in Congress trying to explain themselves. These companies have made a point of saying, if we come up with something, we're going to make it available. It's going to be it's going to be affordable to everyone. So I think that them sort of in that position, I think even Trump would have to concede that they can be part of the solution. And there's lots of things that have to be done within healthcare and pharma to get the world past this pandemic. I don't foresee the idea of reference pricing coming back as being the outcome of those efforts.
So in previous cycles, when we've approached this kind of time, the general consensus in the market has been that, you know, really strong showing from the Democrats, like it's possible that they might be able to take the Senate, so to get the whole of Congress and the White House, and under those circumstances, that's
A sweep.
yeah, a sweep. That's generally perceived to be like a bad thing for the financial markets, and implying tax hikes and things like that. Obviously, with the unique character of President Trump, who's been both a boon and a burden to the markets at different times and in different ways. You know, what are investors in general wanting to, what's going to make them most happy about corporate prospects in terms of a result in November?
You know, it's interesting. I think one thing that I've heard CEOs say, and I think it's true for investors as well, they don't like uncertainty. The good news about waking up the next morning is at least we'll know. And then the markets will know what to do with themselves. And so I would say, again, this is to my thesis around, like, we're going to make money either way. We're going to watch and see how it swings. The pendulum swings back and forth. I think with Trump, you'll probably see a much more aggressive tone, quite a bit of focus on China and how he tariffs will come back into play, and how he feels, you know, the World Health Organization, all of that rhetoric around China comes back. The markets did not like that, and they will continue to not like that. On the flip side, to your point, Biden, you can easily go up and pull down off the website the different taxes he wants to raise on individuals and corporations. And nobody loves taxes in the financial markets, you know, companies hate it. That being said, once they know what the rules are, they'll figure out how to navigate them. So I hate to say it, but there's kind of glass half full, glass half empty with both candidates. Neither candidate is a solid boon nor bust for the market, but I think it's going to, you know, there's going to be opportunities that are going to kind of come and go. And we're going to see that as they prioritize the stuff on their agenda in their presidency. It's not, you know what I mean? It's not a clear portfolio. People love to send around, here's the Biden portfolio, here's the Trump portfolio. I wish it wasn't that easy, and it's not. And to even get to which one will be president, there's going to be lots of trades you can make between here and there to make money, as the market tends to, you know, fear one or the other, I guess.
Okay. Well, look, it's been really useful conversation, but I'll just get one quick question in before we wrap up.
Please,
and obviously,
yes,
the market has recovered, I think, better than a lot of people would have expected. And yet we've got these sort of terrible indications of coronavirus infections picking up. We've got the uncertainty just referenced in terms of the election ahead, and the prospect of a lot of these support programs, you know, having to end at some stage. You know, where does that leave you in terms of the thinking about the outlook for stocks from this point on, say, a 12-month basis or something like that?
I would say on a 12-month basis, I get back to this idea of, you know, the different uncertainties that you're alluding to and you're talking about. We are not a high turnover strategy. I think over the past 12 months, we're probably 20% turnover. My thought is we're going to just continue to be a little bit more active. You know, kind of in the beginning of this year, sort of from February through the end of May, we've added, let's call it eight new names to the portfolio. So I just, you know, it's in times like this where there's a lot of market volatility, we tend to have the opportunity to get new names in the portfolio or redeploy capital to new opportunities. I think that the market's going to be wobbling, you know, and I listen to companies talk. We've done, you know, again, technology. I've actually had the opportunity to get to even more meetings because we don't have to walk to conference calls. I just sit at my desk and do a WebEx or a Skype or a Zoom or a Jabber or a conference call. You know, I can go call to call back to back for meetings faster than a human being can walk from one conference room to the other. So that's been a benefit, I would say, to this new working environment.
Yeah.
And as I listen to those companies, though, and I listen to those managing teams, no one's talking, you know, people are not talking V-shaped recovery. The market likes to discount V-shaped recovery sometimes, but when you listen to the management teams, they're happy to take a V-shaped recovery, but in their desk drawer, they have a W-shaped recovery, they have a U, they have an L. You know, you pick your shape of the recovery. They've got plans to navigate it, and so but that's what I'm expecting in the coming year. You're going to have days where things are green and off to the races, And then we're going to have a day like we did the other day when all of a sudden, you know, Beijing is shut again. The schools are closed. We're seeing things rise, rates rise in Texas and Florida, and the market gets scared. There's a lot of fear. And so that's what I'm expecting. I don't think it's going to be a smooth ride. It's going to be, you know, a bit bumpy. But again, we, you know, my job, my goal is to, you know, keep for myself and the team, keep people's heads away from the screen in that way and just really take an opportunity, because I think the outlook for stocks is going to be bumpy. But companies are, you know, well-positioned. You can find well-positioned companies. You can find companies with solid balance sheets that can navigate this kind of stress and come out the other side, having made some good trades and made some money for people. Basically, that's our goal. That's my outlook. It's not, you know, this is not a simple conversation around what's the PE ratio like versus history, and are we above or below the median? Because to your point before about credit, when you think about credit, when you think about how can earnings be impacted, you know, CEOs and CFOs, they're running lots of scenarios around their earnings streams, and they have to. That's what I need to hear, is we don't have one answer. We have several plans, because they don't know how quickly things reopen. How does this consumer change their behavior? They're going to navigate it. And so, again, I think there's lots of ways we can make money, but I expect that there'll be some, you know, again, some gray days when we have to just, you know, keep our eyes forward, so to speak.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Claire Hart, manager of the JP Morgan US Equity Income Fund. Really fascinating insights. So thanks very much for sharing them with us. And thanks also to all of our listeners for joining us for this podcast, and hopefully joining us again next time for another Brewin podcast as well.